I'm Michael Kasson, founder and CEO of 3C Ventures and your guide on Good Company, the podcast where I sit down with the boldest innovators shaping what's next. In this episode, I'm joined by Anjali Sood, CEO of Tubi. We dive into the competitive world of streaming.
What others dismiss as niche, we embrace as core. There's so many stories out there, and if you can find a way to curate and help the right person discover the right content, the term that we always hear from our audience is that they feel seen.
Listen to Good Company on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Here's the deal. We gotta set ourselves up. See, retirement is the long game. We gotta make moves and make them early. Set up goals. Don't worry about a setback. Just save up and stack up to reach them. Let's put ourselves in the right position. Pre-game to greater things.
Start building your retirement plan at thisispretirement.org. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
I think everything that might have dropped in 95 has been labeled the golden years of hip-hop.
It's Black Music Month, and We Need to Talk is tapping in. I'm Nyla Simone, breaking down lyrics, amplifying voices, and digging into the culture that shaped the soundtrack of our lives.
Like, that's what's really important, and that's what stands out, is that our music changes people's lives for the better.
Let's talk about the music that moves us. To hear this and more on how music and culture collide, listen to We Need to Talk from the Black Effect Podcast Network on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Previously on our coverage of the wrongful conviction of Leonard Peltier, federal prosecutors used false evidence to extradite Leonard Peltier from Canada to the United States. Where his co-defendants had just been acquitted on the grounds of self-defense for the June 1975 fatal shooting deaths of two FBI agents on the Pine Ridge Reservation. So, in preparation for Leonard's trial, they traded a premeditated ambush narrative for one claiming that after the agents pursued Leonard onto Jumping Bull Ranch to serve a warrant, a firefight had ensued. And when the agents were wounded, the feds claimed that Leonard approached them with an AR-15, which ejected a shell casing into the agent's trunk as he executed them in cold blood. But hidden evidence said otherwise. This is Wrongful Conviction. You're listening to Wrongful Conviction. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early and ad-free by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts. Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction for the final episode in our coverage of Leonard Peltier, where, once again, I'm joined by, you know him and you love him, Ben Bolin, from the podcast Stuff They Don't Want You to Know.
Thank you, Jason. We'll pick up on this story where we left off. When the federal prosecutors have been granted a change of venue from Cedar Rapids, Iowa, to Fargo, North Dakota, where Judge Paul Benson cited mental incompetence when barring Myrtle Poorbear from testifying about how FBI agents coerced her into swearing falsely in three affidavits to obtain Leonard's extradition from Canada.
It certainly looks like she was just of no use to them anymore for the purposes of Leonard's trial in March 1977, where the feds once again were up to their same dirty tricks trying to influence the jury.
Because the jurors were sequestered during Leonard's trial for their own safety. They were under 24-hour U.S. Marshal protection. And what we didn't know was that they were transported to the courtroom from their hotel, back to their hotel for lunch, et cetera, back and forth the end of the day. And the windows of this bus were taped up because they were told that this would prevent them from being shot at by snipers.
Wow.
And there were sniper teams very visible on the roof.
Those snipers were FBI agents, but the alleged threat was from AIM and their supporters.
The way the jurors came out of the building, the bus was parked about 15 feet from the entrance. The door bursts open. A team of marshals come and fan out, and then they usher these jurors in fast as they can so they don't get shot between the building and the bus. You do this four times a day for 6 weeks, you're going to have an impression.
That's like psychological warfare.
It was all about creating a climate of fear and terror. They did it in the courtroom. We had 25 marshals in the courtroom at all times. We had agents sitting behind us with submachine guns in cases.
In addition to the terror tactics, the prosecution team of Lynn Crooks, Evan Holtman, and Robert Sikma were able to take the self-defense claim off the table with the execution narrative, which in turn barred witness testimony about the Goon Squad's federally funded terror campaign that made self-defense in gun battle the norm on Pine Ridge. And now, with Jimmy Eagle also out of the picture, they needed witnesses to place Leonard in the car allegedly being chased by the agents.
And suddenly a young man, Michael Anderson, who was 15 years old at the time, in every statement he had given previously said he was in the camp when the firefight started, suddenly was a quarter mile away and on the roof of one of the houses and watched a vehicle drive in chased by the two agents. And it wasn't a red pickup like the agents described, but it was a red and white van like they found up in the camp and had been seen up by the houses at one point. So Mike's telling the story and he describes it as the agents following an orange pickup. And the prosecutor says, now, when you say orange pickup, do you mean a red and white van? And he said, yes.
That day, the agents had clearly radioed in, describing a red pickup like the one that Jimmy Eagle drove. But since the charges against Jimmy had been dropped, the narrative became Leonard in his red and white van. Anderson also said that he'd come running back to the campground to grab a rifle and saw Leonard with an AR-15. On cross-examination, Mike Anderson admitted that his charges relating to the exploding car in Wichita were dropped in exchange for this testimony. In a similar vein, Wilford Draper admitted that he'd been threatened with indictment for the murder himself, so he agreed to testify that the group had knowledge of the FBI agents' cars on the day prior and that he had seen Leonard with an AR-15. Norman Brown flat out refused to repeat his testimony from the Butler-Robidoux trial that he'd seen the trio near the agent's car. He said, quote, it was the agents who said that I saw them, end quote. And he added that he, too, had been threatened with the indictment.
Yes, the witnesses testified that their family was threatened, their mothers were threatened, and they were threatened, of course, and tried to recant any kind of statement that they were forced to make before. So it was no evidence. Nobody said that I was shooting at anybody or killing anybody.
No one witnessed anyone allegedly performing this execution on these two agents. And the medical evidence was that the agents were shot by a high-velocity rifle at close range, and that Agent Williams had a defensive wound on his right hand, and that the gun must have been pressed against it before firing through his hand and his head. But strangely, there was no mention whatsoever of the burn wounds that are associated with close-range gunshots. I'm going to pause on that for a second. And both bodies, by the way, were discovered face down, which does not fit the scenario they described. But the theory was accepted at face value, and then came the ballistics.
Essentially, it boiled down to two things. Number one, there was one and only one AR-15 that was present at the Jumping Bull compound at that time, according to the witness testimony, and that Peltier had been seen with an AR-15, and therefore the Wichita AR-15 was Leonard Peltier's AR-15. Now look, there's a few problems with that. Number one is there's no proof that the Wichita AR-15 found in the car months later was ever at the Jumping Bull compound. And more important, there was evidence that the government was aware of that there were numerous AR-15s present at that time that were firing bullets because they found other shell casings at the scene, and they found other bullets at the scene. That information was suppressed. The second thing that was crucial was that the very firearms expert who testified for the government had sent a teletype while the investigation was still going on, saying that the shell casing that was found in the agent's car did not match the Wichita AR-15. It was from a different gun, and this was based on a firing pin test.
If you recall from part two of our coverage, we discussed the mechanics of a semi-automatic weapon and how, although this type of analysis is best suited for excluding weapons rather than matchmaking, a firing pin test is the most reliable for identifying an individual weapon. While an extractor mark can merely identify things like make or model, the FBI firearm analyst, Evan Hodge, testified that the casing had been loaded and extracted from the Wichita AR-15. This is why it was so important for both there to have been only one AR-15 and that it be placed in Leonard's possession. However, there were other AR-15s. And when they'd received the fire-damaged AR-15 from Wichita, the bolt mechanism was removed and it was placed in a different AR-15. According to an October 1975 teletype, a firing pin test of that Wichita AR-15 was negative for a match with the casing from Agent Kohler's trunk.
That was never given over to the defense. Had those two pieces of information been given to the defense, obviously the defense would have been in a position to undermine the entire case against Leonard Peltier. And make no mistake about it, the case was presented as Leonard Peltier being the person wielding the Wichita AR-15 who walked up to both agents as they lay wounded and executed them both with one shell casing being discarded into the agent's car. That was the theory of the trial. That was what the jury believed, and that's how the conviction arose.
The prosecutor, he made a statement at the closing arguments that I was a cold-blooded killer, executioner, and was effective, I guess.
They added that the witnesses who undermined their own testimony perhaps should have been tried too, calling AIM a blood-crazed bunch, and however undermined that testimony was, it aligned with what appeared to be scientific evidence related to this one shell casing that may or may not have been ejected into this agent's trunk. When you think about it, with all of the other lies, it's hard to know whether to believe this or any of this so-called evidence. But nonetheless, on the fateful day of April 18th, 1977, Leonard Peltier was convicted on two counts of first-degree murder.
The clerk of the court told us, Judge Benson's not going to give you no more than 30 years. I would get out in 15, I think, some of that. But I was so fucking upset that I wrote a very strong anti-government statement. I condemned the court, I condemned the judge and the whole system with such disregard for the Constitution, attempts at exterminating us. And I read that just before he sentenced me, and he gave me two life sentences. So if I'd have kept my mouth shut, I probably would have been out after 15 years. But I was just so fucking angry that I just couldn't control myself.
I think everything that might have dropped in 95 has been labeled the golden years of hip-hop.
It's Black Music Month, and We Need to Talk is tapping in. I'm Nyla Simone, breaking down lyrics, amplifying voices, and digging into the culture that shaped the soundtrack of our lives.
My favorite line on there was, my son and my daughter going to be proud when they hear my old tapes.
Yeah.
Now, I'm curious, do they, like, rap along now?
Yeah, because I bring him on tour with me, and he's getting older now, too. So his friends are starting to understand what that type of music is, and they're starting to be like, yo, your dad's, like, really the GOAT, like, he's a legend, so he gets it.
What does it mean to leave behind a music legacy for your family?
It means a lot to me, just having a good catalog and just being able to make people feel good. Like, that's what's really important, and that's what stands out, is that our music changes people's lives for the better. So the fact that my kids get to benefit off of that, I'm really happy. Or my family in general.
Let's talk about the music that moves us. To hear this and more on how music and culture collide, listen to We Need to Talk from the Black Effect Podcast Network on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This Pride Month, we are not just celebrating. We're fighting back. I'm George M. Johnson, and my book, All Boys Aren't Blue, was just named the most banned book in America. If the culture wars have taught me anything, it's that pride is protest. And on my podcast, Fighting Words, we talk to people who use their voices to resist, disrupt, and make our community stronger.
This year, we are showing up and showing out. You need people being like, no, you're not going to tell us what to do.
This regime is coming down on us. And I don't want to just survive. I want to thrive.
You'll hear from trailblazers like Bob the Drag Queen.
To freedom!
Angelica Ross.
We ready to fight? I'm ready to fight.
And Gabrielle Union.
Hi, George.
And storytellers with wisdom to spare. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The American West with Dan Flores is the latest show from the Meat Eater Podcast Network, hosted by me, writer and historian Dan Flores, and brought to you by Velvet Buck. This podcast looks at a West available nowhere else. Each episode, I'll be diving into some of the lesser-known histories of the West. I'll then be joined in conversation by guests such as Western historian Dr. Randall Williams and best-selling author and Meat Eater founder Stephen Ranella.
I'll correct my kids now and then where they'll say when cave people were here. And I'll say, it seems like the Ice Age people that were here didn't have a real affinity for caves.
So join me starting Tuesday, May 6th, where we'll delve into stories of the West and come to understand how it helps inform the ways in which we experience the region today.
Listen to The American West with Dan Flores on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Right after I was convicted, the elders came up to the railing there and said, "We want you to know that we will fight for you for the rest of our lives if you're still in prison, and our children will fight for you for the rest of their lives, and if you're still in there, our grandkids will fight for you." They sent me to Marion, Illinois, the harshest prison that they had at that time. It took the place of Alcatraz. They put me in a hole there and so that they can find it. I went to a hearing about 30 days later, and a captain there sentenced me to a sensory deprivation cell indefinitely.
Oh my God.
It's complete darkness. You only got one blanket to sleep on, and the only time you get light is when they open the food slot. People come out of there completely nuts. Some people never come out of there. I was supposed to die in there. I said a lot of prayers to Wonka Tonka, Gitchimanadu, that's the great spirit. And I just made my mind up, you ain't going to break me. But my lawyers and other people were fighting. They finally got a hearing, and the Supreme Court said, you cannot resentence people to these type of cells. He's already been sentenced. And beside that, that cell you got there is illegal.
At this point, Leonard's appeals had been picked up by Dino and Bob's attorney, William Kunstler, and this small victory over cruel and unusual punishment came along with the denial of his direct appeal, at which time Leonard was transferred to another facility, Lompoc.
And when I got there, I couldn't believe it. I mean, this was so many holes.
Holes in the wall?
No, I mean, to escape.
Like the fencing and lower security.
Yeah, and some of the towers wasn't occupied. And I was looking around there. I said, wow. So first opportunity I got, we went out during the night. Made it across the fence, and they were shooting at us by then. And Dallas Thundershield had his arms up surrendering, and they shot him in the back. I was able to escape, and I was gone 5 days out in the desert.
And made it to Santa Maria, California.
Yes, about 25 miles from the prison. I was heading for Mexico. I was going out there to Nicaragua, and I was sitting under this tree, and I happened to look down to the lower grounds, and I seen this garden. And I thought, gee, well, it'd be nice to sit up here and eat a melon or whatever else I could. So I go down to this garden, and all of a sudden this guy starts shooting at me. I put my arms up. He got close enough to me where I snatched the gun out of his hand. And he said, I suppose you're going to kill me now. And I looked at him. I said, what the fuck? You try to kill me, you fucking asshole. Oh, excuse my language. But he got all panicky now. He was crying and everything. And he said, no, I wasn't just trying to chase you out of my garden. And I said, you're lying. And I just said, nah, I can't do this. And I told him, I said, well, don't be running, calling the cops. Let me get away from here. Okay, okay. But he called the cops as soon as he could, I guess. Because they come all from all directions. But when they had me on the ground, this deputy sheriff was putting on handcuffs on me. And the FBI agent came and put that barrel right here. And he said, "You son of a bitch, you killed two of my friends. I'm going to blow your fucking brains out." And I just looked at him. I said, "Well, do it. Fucking brave ass bull motherfucker, now that I'm handcuffed and everything." I said, "Do it. Shoot." And the deputy sheriff, we started shaking on my back. And he said, "I'm not going to be part of no killing." So they must have been talking about it to see me kill me.
Leonard got 7 more years for the escape and weapons possession. By this time, every new class of FBI agents was being indoctrinated with the image of Leonard Peltier as their boogeyman. And meanwhile, in Canada, the Solicitor General, a guy named Warren Almond, began to make noise about how the FBI and prosecutors had presented Myrtle Pourbaix's perjured affidavits at Leonard's extradition hearing.
The native people in Canada forced them to do an investigation on the extradition. Then they sealed it for 40 years. Warren Almond was very upset about it. It took him another year to get in there and read this investigation report. And he found a letter in there from the Justice Department here in the United States that said, if you put in this investigation and release it, we would hold the $55 million that we're going to send you through the Joint Agricultural Laboratory.
Wow.
With Warren Allman's efforts neutered, Leonard's team also exhausted the Myrtle Pourbaix evidence in post-conviction.
On the Myrtle Pourbaix thing, the judge asked Evan Haltman, "We don't understand how anyone could continue to extract information from this witness, because it's quite obvious she was not a real witness." So Haltman said, "Your Honor, I had nothing to do with her. And when I read her affidavit, I knew there was not one scintilla of truth." A few years later, we find a document. He had flew into Rapid City, and prosecutor that was representing the United States and Canada flew in from Canada, and they wrote her third affidavit.
So Evan Holtman's deception was once again not discovered until it was too late. And around this time is when Ron Kuby got involved.
When I was a law student way back in 1982, I started interning for William Kunstler. And at that point, he was very deeply involved in trying to secure a new trial for Leonard Peltier. And so I started working on that case almost immediately and continued when I was finally admitted to the bar in 1984. Kunstler had obtained new information that he believed was the key to getting Leonard a new trial.
So here we had ballistics evidence I mentioned before. The agent gets on the stand and he says, "Well, we can't definitively do a firing pin test, but we can do an extractor mark test. And in fact, there's a match." And for lawyers, if you see a word in a government document that refers to another document, you got to go after it.
I think it was a Freedom of Information Act request. Kunstler learned of the existence of this teletype from Agent Hodge, which had been suppressed.
We asked for 2 October 2nd teletypes that we had not gotten. Not only could that damaged AR-15 from Kansas, at least the one that they used to test, could produce a firing pin test, but those teletypes revealed that there was no match.
Whatsoever.
Whatsoever.
In previous episodes, we've covered the FBI crime lab and the culture of misconduct, false testimony, and manipulating evidence that was exposed in the mid-90s by a whistleblower named Frederick Whitehurst, who came forward at great personal and professional risk. We're going to link to our coverage of Elmer Daniels, who was interviewed by fellow exoneree, death row exoneree, by the way, John Huffington, both of whom had been victims of false testimony from the FBI crime lab. And it appears that this culture of misconduct was present during Leonard's trial, as Evan Hodge testified that his test casings and the casing from Kohler's trunk were loaded and unloaded from that particular rifle, while this October 1975 firing pin test said otherwise.
And based on that, I filed a motion for a new trial. There was a very extensive evidentiary hearing where Agent Evan Hodge tried to say he didn't mean to suggest that he was talking about the shell casing found in the agent's car. He was testing other shell casings. And it's like, really? The most important piece of evidence in the case, and you send a teletype about other shell casings belonging to other AR-15s, which the FBI claim weren't even at the scene, made no sense, clearly a lie. But something very interesting happened in the course of the argument on that appeal. The government was not convinced they were going to win. The Eighth Circuit was skeptical, or at least made skeptical sounds. And so during oral argument, the government said, look, we may not be able to prove that, in fact, it was Peltier who fired the fatal bullets at close range.
He said, Your Honor, I want you to know the government doesn't know who the shooter is, nor what participation Leonard Peltier may have had in it.
The government switched from Leonard doing it to, no, Leonard was just an aider and abettor.
That was an amazing concession, because for over a decade, the government and the FBI had been relentlessly saying that Leonard Peltier walked up to two wounded agents, executed them at point-blank range. And suddenly the government's saying, well, okay, maybe not, but he was shooting at them. Nonetheless, the judge denied the motion, and on appeal, the Eighth Circuit said it would possibly have helped Peltier's defense to have this teletype. It would have helped impeach the agent. It would have helped to establish that there were other AR-15s at the scene. But we're not convinced, under the Brady standard, that this was sufficiently material to create a reasonable possibility that a jury would have come to a different conclusion had they heard this evidence.
Come again? What? Okay, so this Brady violation destroys the alleged evidence that Leonard had executed two wounded FBI agents in cold blood, leaving him, as it was now framed, as an alleged aider and abettor.
And that's where then it became an issue, because wait a minute, if he was just an aider and abettor, then how could the judge deny him the same defense that Daryl Butler and Bob Robbie had, where they were able to show that they had reasons to act in self-defense on that day?
So we go back into court, once again, using the government's concession as a basis for a new trial. And again, the Eighth Circuit manages to affirm the conviction, pointing out that in the indictment, Peltier was named as an aider and abettor. So in theory, the conviction could be upheld, even though that was not the case the government put on.
I think everything that might have dropped in 95 has been labeled the golden years of hip-hop.
It's Black Music Month, and We Need to Talk is tapping in. I'm Nyla Simone, breaking down lyrics, amplifying voices, and digging into the culture that shaped the soundtrack of our lives.
My favorite line on there was, my son and my daughter are going to be proud when they hear my old tapes.
Yeah.
Now, I'm curious, do they, like, rap along now?
Yeah, because I bring him on tour with me, and he's getting older now, too. So his friends are starting to understand what that type of music is, and they're starting to be like, yo, your dad's, like, really the GOAT, like, he's a legend, so he gets it.
What does it mean to leave behind a music legacy for your family?
It means a lot to me, just having a good catalog and just being able to make people feel good. Like, that's what's really important, and that's what stands out, is that our music changes people's lives for the better. So the fact that my kids get to benefit off of that, I'm really happy. Or my family in general.
Let's talk about the music that moves us. To hear this and more on how music and culture collide, listen to We Need to Talk from the Black Effect Podcast Network on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This Pride Month, we are not just celebrating. We're fighting back. I'm George M. Johnson, and my book, All Boys Aren't Blue, was just named the most banned book in America. If the culture wars have taught me anything, it's that pride is protest. And on my podcast, Fighting Words, we talk to people who use their voices to resist, disrupt, and make our community stronger.
This year, we are showing up and showing out.
You need people being like, no, you're not going to tell us what to do.
This regime is coming down on us. And I don't want to just survive. I want to thrive.
You'll hear from trailblazers like Bob the Drag Queen.
To freedom!
Angelica Ross.
We ready to fight? I'm ready to fight.
And Gabrielle Union.
Hi, George.
And storytellers with wisdom to spare. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The American West with Dan Flores is the latest show from the Meat Eater Podcast Network, hosted by me, writer and historian Dan Flores, and brought to you by Velvet Buck. This podcast looks at a West available nowhere else. Each episode, I'll be diving into some of the lesser-known histories of the West. I'll then be joined in conversation by guests such as Western historian Dr. Randall Williams and best-selling author and Meat Eater founder Stephen Ranella.
I'll correct my kids now and then where they'll say when cave people were here. And I'll say, it seems like the Ice Age people that were here didn't have a real affinity for caves.
So join me starting Tuesday, May 6th, where we'll delve into stories of the West and come to understand how it helps inform the ways in which we experience the region today.
Listen to The American West with Dan Flores on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Leonard, all these years, decades in prison, 49 years and 11 days, how did you manage to find hope inside those walls all those years?
I didn't join the rest of inmates. I didn't go into what they usually do, drugs and drinking and things like that. I kind of went into my own little group. We played handball, worked out in the weights and painting. I went into the art room and I decided I was going to develop my artwork. And I went to school for a while, helped Peter Matheson write In the Spirit of Crazy Horse. And then I eventually wrote my own book, Prison Writings. And In the Spirit of Crazy Horse went to a number one bestseller in the world. The FBI filed a $20 million lawsuit. Bill Jankel, the governor of South Dakota, filed a $25 million lawsuit. They held it off the bookshelves for 8.5 years. It cost us $2.5 million to defend ourselves.
And I hope everyone will order a copy of that book. But you had on your side not just Pope Francis, Archbishop Tutu, Mother Teresa, Nelson Mandela, Muhammad Ali,
Marlon Brando, Robert Redford, Peter Coyote,
the Dalai Lama, Coretta Scott King,
Santana, Grateful Dead, Willie Nelson,
Johnny Depp,
yes.
Of course, Rage Against the Machine.
Yeah.
I know a lot of Gen Xers and millennials like myself were too young to know about Leonard when the case happened back in 1975. Some of us weren't born yet. However, a lot of people heard about Leonard when the music video for Freedom by Rage Against the Machine was released on MTV, back when that was, you know, still a thing. If you went to a Rage show, especially in support of that album, you heard a lot about Leonard. And that was 1994. And his cause gained a lot of political momentum toward the end of the Clinton administration, not just because of Rage Against the Machine, but also because a former FBI agent turned congressman, Don Edwards, joined the cause as well.
Don Edwards, he was a supporter of mine. And he was doing an interview and they asked him, they said, why are you supporting someone that was convicted of killing two of your agents? He said, I worked there. I know what they did to Leonard. Hmm. And there's others. There's probably about 10 more FBI agents that came forward and said, they don't use this term, but it meant they manufactured evidence and tortured witnesses and things like that.
So the political will was primed for Clinton's final days in office as a team of people, including Bruce Ellison, advocated passionately for Leonard's clemency.
And we got some very interesting contacts from some Hollywood folks who had regular contacts with the Clintons. We met with White House counsel and chief of staff. We had a really good meeting.
Was that Bruce Lindsay?
Bruce Lindsay was one of the participants, yes. Mm-hmm. And leading up to this, about several weeks before, Senator Daschle from South Dakota, who was the Senate Majority Leader at the time, took William Janklow, who was...
Well, Leonard told us about his early life, too. He's a reprehensible character across the board.
Yeah, he was basically convicted in tribal court of child rape.
If you remember, we talked about Bill Janklow's privileged existence. His alleged serial rape ignored not only by law enforcement, but by South Dakota voters, paving the way to Janklow becoming attorney general,
governor of South Dakota twice, as well as his path to Congress. And after all this time, for Leonard and Ames' audacity to raise Jancita Eagle Deer's allegations during Janklow's run for AG in 1974, Janklow actively lobbied against Leonard's clemency in the year 2000.
Daschle leads Janklow in to meet with Clinton. Clinton was told that South Dakota senator would lose the next election. It was going to cost the Democrats the Senate if he pardoned Peltier, which was bullshit. But we have this meeting the next week. This is on like a Friday, a week before Clinton's leaving office. And it goes great. And in fact, I was asked to draft up a bunch of bullet points for Clinton to say at a press conference announcing the clemency. And then on Wednesday of the following week, Clinton's lawyers, according to the Hollywood People, said that meeting on Wednesday was about whether Clinton was going to be indicted for perjury in front of the grand jury, Whitewater grand jury, Monica Lewinsky grand jury, and other things. And I've been through lots of times where they do questioning and work out deals and all this stuff. And basically, while I don't know the exact words, Leonard's name came up four times during the day's discussions. And basically, Clinton got the idea, and he was told, look, if you grant this clemency, anytime you want your $100,000, $200,000 speaking engagements, wherever you are in the country or the world, it's going to get picketed by cops, and we're going to make it difficult for you to earn your money. Well, you can do nothing. And he did nothing.
By this time, the Supreme Court had also ignored Leonard's case, despite the blatant material Brady violation. And so the legal battle began to focus on obtaining an estimated 100,000 undisclosed FBI documents through FOIA requests to see what else they could find.
Leonard went through a number of lawyers who were fighting this issue, and he re-enlisted me, I think, back in 2006, back in the O's. We got a lot of documents, and a lot of documents we didn't get, and a lot of documents we still haven't received.
But nothing of note was handed over. Meanwhile, as sentencing law went before 1984, despite his double life sentence, Leonard became eligible for parole after 25 years, plus the 7 years he'd gotten for the escape and weapon possession. And his lawyer made a strong presentation that was summarily denied for an additional 15 years, during which time they lobbied the Obama administration twice to no avail. And Leonard was denied parole again at the parole board in 2024, with just a few months left in the Biden administration.
Administrations far more sympathetic to Native American issues refused to grant him clemency. Every judicial remedy had been exhausted. I mean, there's two ways to look at the legal fight. One way is that ongoing, consistent legal battles chipping away at the prosecution's case helped enable the mass movement that eventually succeeded in winning clemency for Peltier. That's what I choose to believe. There is another position you could take, which is despite hundreds of thousands of lawyer hours being poured into the case, nothing that any of the dozens of lawyers did accomplished a single damn thing for Leonard.
But my people have never given up on me. That was very, very encouraging.
You know, Leonard's long had such international recognition and efforts at justice put forth, and that have always been ignored. But the combination this time worked. You know, all the tribal leaders got together. Secretary Hedlund spoke to Biden a couple of times privately. There was a lot of people who were just making a lot of things happen. And then Nick Tilson and Holly really just did a tremendous job. And so anyway, somewhere in this mix, Biden decides to do the right thing.
So Holly Macaro and Nick Tilson from an advocacy group called Indian Collective, along with a former federal judge named Kevin Sharp, petitioned the Biden administration for clemency. And there's a documentary called Free Leonard Peltier that we're going to link in the episode description. I highly recommend it, by the way. The moment the news came through was caught on video. It gave me full body chills watching that. And Holly Macaro, she was actually there for this incredible moment.
On the day that Leonard was granted clemency, I was in the parking lot in Florida. He was in Coleman, the Federal Max. We had told Leonard that we had had some strong indications and were feeling very positive. But again, we had to see it in writing because of what happened with Clinton, where they told him he's on the list, then they wake up and he wasn't on the list. So we expected it to be on Monday morning. So we're in the parking lot. We prayed, we sang our songs, we smudged, and I was in very close contact with several folks within the White House. While we were waiting, Fred DeJarlie, who's a spiritual leader, he was with us, and he said, there's an eagle over there. And I didn't know that there were bald eagles in Florida that far south. And we all looked, and there were two eagles circling above us. You could hear them whistling. That was maybe then around 11:15 a.m. and 16, 17, 18. We were hitting refresh on whitehouse.gov over and over.
I was too.
Yeah. If I never have to hit refresh again, it'll be too soon. But I had already begun receiving notes from friends and family and folks who know I had been working in advocacy for Leonard, and that saying, oh, I'm really sorry, because there was already video of the president leaving the White House and heading for the Capitol on inauguration day there. So I think it was 11:44 when the announcement came through. And we celebrated in the parking lot there. On that initial announcement, it was just that he had commuted his sentence. We didn't receive the detail with the home confinement or the date of February 18th until a couple of hours later. And Leonard called me and almost exactly an hour later. And he said, well, my dear, I've been on pins and needles. I've been up since midnight. He said, did he do it? And I said, yes, Leonard, President Biden granted you clemency with 16 minutes left in his administration. He said, did you see it in writing? And I said, I saw it in writing. And then Leonard said, so it's real then. It's real. I said, yes, it's real. You'll be going home.
I didn't really believe that I got it. Even after the warden called me down, gave me a copy of this commendation and everything. And I said, ah, this is all a joke, man. And so I really didn't believe it. Even for a few days later, they're going to come tell me at any moment it's all bullshit and they were playing games or whatever else. So that's what went through my mind.
And honestly, I don't think anybody saw that coming. I think that most of us, if we're going to be honest with ourselves, never thought we would see the day that Leonard would walk out of prison alive. And it was just ironic. It took a man with absolutely no political future left to him to summon up the political will to go ahead and sign that paper.
I got in a car with Holly and Nick and told them, let's get the hell out of here.
We had a ribbon shirt. We had new moccasins for him as he began this new path forward. And then we had a ceremony to help him leave some of this behind him and flew him home to Turtle Mountain.
Leonard is finally out of prison, but he is still under house arrest per the terms of his clemency.
Which, come on, house arrest? After what we've heard here? But at least Leonard is finally able to breathe free air, see family and friends, and see a doctor outside of prison.
After 50 years of medical neglect, he is in dire need of medical attention at the age of 80. We will link ways to donate in the episode description here, as well as other action steps. And, of course, we asked Leonard and Bruce what else people can do.
I need my story told again and again and again, because hopefully it will help my people.
This is a message for people, lawyers, who I want to encourage young lawyers to get involved. But that is, you got to remember that this is a war, and it's a real war, and they fight it in different ways. And yes, there are risks, because we know the American government works in a way that they never go after people for political reasons. They're always going after them because they're criminals. When J. Edgar Hoover passed away, if you read a book by Sanford Unger about the FBI, the post-war FBI, one of the things he mentions in there was to cover that up and make it legal, they entered instructions that if you decided to actually target a person, you have to put in some crime that you believe that you're actually investigating, so that whatever the result is, it's not because they're trying to defend their people. They want to protect the land from a hazardous pipeline. It's because they're engaged in criminal activities. Hmm. And thus we have the world that we have today, right? Where we're going to watch people rounded up. There's always going to be some law that they're going to try and claim. Now, they're having a little problem with the immigration stuff. But really, they're going to pass laws in Congress. They're going to do what they did in South Dakota and a lot of other places, where what they call anti-riot booster laws, where they essentially criminalize nonviolent civil disobedience as terrorism. the struggle to protect the earth, to protect the people in terms of having a livable world and a sustainable world and a free world, that struggle is now reaching another height. There's new renewed Indian activism, and the government is going after people now. So we have like the next wave, which is coming. And men like Leonard Peltier and Dino Butler, though, they're the ones that will help and are helping to inspire the young people and give a direction of discipline and love.
And honor.
And respect. It's been an honor of mine, despite what I have gone through. And I got a lot of messages for lawyers who want to get involved in this particular work. Be prepared for anything because you get treated like the people you're representing. They literally think you're part of it. And to some extent, I honorably became part of that because this is the real world. These are things that affect people's daily ability to survive.
We have a tradition here at Wrongful Conviction. It's called Closing Arguments, and it's where I, first of all, thank you again from the bottom of my heart for being here and sharing this story with us. And then I'm just going to kick back in my chair and listen to anything else you feel has been left unsaid.
I think it is so important to tell this story. It's about injustice, eventual justice. When we share this story with audiences like yours, it helps us ensure that this will never happen again, but it also lets us know that the work continues. Many of the things that inspired the birth of the American Indian Movement in Minneapolis and that inspired Dino and Leonard and other leaders of the movement back then, those conditions exist today. Their activism and voices brought us to the table in the 1970s and inspired landmark legislation that we all rely on today to protect American Indian rights. But some of those conditions exist today, and I think Leonard, looking forward, has an important platform and role of leadership in making sure that the injustice doesn't happen again, but that we are also always making the noise to protect our people.
In these dangerous and threatening times, it is important for us to remember that we can either go as sheep or we can stand up. And if we stand up, and especially stand up for those who are being threatened by aspects of our system that's designed to stop exposure, the truth, the reality of too many people in this country, and we figure out how to do it together and do it with love. But most importantly, there's too many people who've been wrongfully convicted and who are still in prison. And anyone who can do anything to help, information, whatever, don't forget those people. You just never know what might happen if you keep trying and you keep sending all those prayers and strength and love to those who are decision-making. It's keeping that person strong and healthy. So I guess that's what I'd say, because it's only together we can do this, and we can.
I can't express how I'm actually feeling about this freedom. I never expected it. I didn't think it was going to happen. I thought I was going to die in prison. But it isn't just about Leonard Peltier. It's about the struggle. It's about what they did or tried to do to us natives. They tried to exterminate us. We were not supposed to exist no more. We were supposed to be gone by 1985. That's when the extermination policy was supposed to be completed. So for me to be able to fight for my people and sacrifice is an honor. I would not hesitate to fight for them again, even though I went through 50 years in prison. It's just something that was an honor for me to fight for my people. And it's an honor for me to be able to talk to them now, to all the people around the world that supported me. It's something I can't really express. How grateful I am, how honored I am that they would put me in this position. And I'm just very grateful for everything everybody's doing.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early and ad-free by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts. I want to thank our production team, Connor Hall and Kathleen Fink, as well as my fellow executive producers, Jeff Kempler, Kevin Wardis, and Jeff Kleiber. The music in this production was supplied by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer, Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us across all social media platforms at Lava for Good and at Wrongful Conviction. You can also follow me on Instagram at It's Jason Flom. Wrongful Conviction is a production of Lava for Good Podcasts in association with Signal Company No. 1.
We have worked hard to ensure that all facts reported in this show are accurate. The views and opinions expressed by the individuals featured in this show are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of Lava for Good.
I'm Michael Kasson, founder and CEO of 3C Ventures and your guide on Good Company, the podcast where I sit down with the boldest innovators shaping what's next. In this episode, I'm joined by Anjali Sood, CEO of Tubi. We dive into the competitive world of streaming.
What others dismiss as niche, we embrace as core. There's so many stories out there, and if you can find a way to curate and help the right person discover the right content, the term that we always hear from our audience is that they feel seen.
Listen to Good Company on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Here's the deal. We gotta set ourselves up. See, retirement is the long game. We gotta make moves and make them early. Set up goals. Don't worry about a setback. Just save up and stack up to reach them. Let's put ourselves in the right position. Pre-game to greater things.
Start building your retirement plan at thisispretirement.org. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
What up, y'all? This your main man, Memphis Bleek, right here, host of Rock Solid Podcast. June is Black Music Month, so what better way to celebrate than listening to my exclusive conversation with my bro, Ja Rule?
The one thing they can't stop you or take away from you is knowledge. So whatever I went through while I was down in prison for 2 years, through that process, learn from it.
Check out this exclusive episode with Ja Rule on Rock Solid. Open your free iHeartRadio app, search Rock Solid, and listen now.